Things happen very quietly sometimes, which by and by are seen to have had enormous impact. That's how it was with a book called the Scofield Reference Bible, published 80 years ago with an extraordinary emphasis on the doctrine of the second coming of Christ. Ever since, there has been a flooding river of sermons, articles, and books on this dramatic topic. Certain churches maintain a high level of excitement by telling their members that the world will end next week, next month, before the year is over. It's good for attendance. No one wants to be a lukewarm Christian if the end is in sight. And it's good for fundraising. No one wants to be stingy if there is no future except in heaven. One of my clearest memories as a boy is of a little stone four-square gospel church on a corner near my house, where from time to time the preacher would announce that he and his church members would meet every single night until the Lord came again. I would ride by on my bicycle, notice the stooped and weary fathers and mothers coming back to that place to sit until 11 o'clock, night after night, for weeks. And I would feel a deep sadness for what seemed to me to be a misguided devotion. I was already reading some Christian history, and I wondered if they knew that in every single decade, over the last 2,000 years, somebody had confidently predicted the imminent arrival of the Lord. Repeatedly, under the urging of some self-appointed prophet, people have left their homes, sold their properties, gathered on some hilltop or in some building to sing and pray until Jesus comes to sweep them up to heaven. It never happens. But there is always someone ready to reset the date and whip up the faithful to a frenzy of sacrifice and high hope. It began, of course, almost immediately in the history of the church. Paul comforted the church in Rome by writing, "You know what hour it is," in reference to the widespread belief that the return of Christ would happen at any moment. "The Lord is at hand," he wrote to the Philippians. And the phrase does not mean by and by. It means right away, on the immediate horizon. This was the watchword and conviction of early Christians everywhere. Insults and persecutions were hard to take, but all those troubles would soon be over. The Lord was coming in their own lifetime. So you read in 1 Peter 4, "The end of all things is at hand." And in 1 John 2, "Children, it is the last hour." And in James 5, "The coming of the Lord is at hand." And in the book of Revelation, "He who testifies to these things says, surely I am coming soon." 2,000 years have passed, and nothing of the kind has happened. So modern prophets are forced to stretch phrases like "at hand" and "soon" to cover all those centuries, but that distorts the text and makes the original authors guilty either of ignorance or of deception. Nothing could have been more cruel than for them to make such promises if they knew all the time, guided by the Spirit they claimed, that long after their readers had been dust for ages, Jesus still would not have come. But the truth is that they were not deliberately deceptive. They were completely convinced that he would come in their own lifetime. It seemed to them that this was exactly what Jesus meant when he was quoted as having promised that this generation will not pass away until all these things have taken place. But a serious problem arose within a few years. The Lord did not come. The kings of earth were still in charge. Christians were still being oppressed. So their hearts began to fail for two reasons. First, there was the scoffing of pagans and devout Jews all around who ridiculed their hope and pointed out that things were going on just as they always had. If their Christ was going to come, why did he not come now when their need was so great? And second, and perhaps even more painful, some of that generation was passing away, and what would happen to them now that were gone before the second coming took place? Would they have any part in it? Christians who lived at Thessalonica, for example, were deeply worried about this, and so the Apostle Paul had to try to comfort them. He told them how it would be, how it would happen, using the traditional Jewish imagery he had learned in school. There would be a great shout of command, the cry of an archangel, the sound of God's trumpet, and then their friends and family who had died in disappointment would rise first. So even if the promise had been delayed a few years, it would be all right. And then, said Paul, who still firmly believed that the second coming would take place in his own generation, we who are alive, we who are left, will be caught up with them to meet the Lord in the air. Now, if Paul had had any notion that nearly 20 centuries later, this event would still not have happened, he would have said something quite different. He would have said something surely like this: those who are alive at that time. But he was sure that many of them would still be alive, including himself. A few years passed, and he began to revise his views a little. The Lord had not come, so in Philippians he indicates that perhaps death will cut him down too before the great event. But even so, he uses a Greek word about the coming of Christ, which literally means stretching out the head, craning the neck, to see something which is on the immediate horizon. Not over the hills of 20 centuries, but over the horizon. But Paul died too, and the Lord still had not come. And generations came and passed away while the church fathers went on writing about how soon it would happen. Understandably, some people began to be skeptical. So the nature of the arguments in Christian writing had to change a little. For example, the second letter with Peter's name on it, explains it like this. It's true that he hasn't come, but you have to look at it this way. With the Lord, one day is as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years as one day. And so the concept has gotten more flexible to fit the facts. And besides, the writer points out, the delay is because he is so patient with us and is giving us time to repent and get our lives in order. It sounds to some students of the Bible like a rationalization. I get the feeling that this writer really hoped Christians would stop setting dates. But if so, he was doomed to disappointment. In every single generation since, some part of the church has predicted the second coming, waited eagerly, and then when nothing happened, has let a few years pass while people forgot, and then has set the date once more. One of the best descriptions of this mindset that I have seen is found in a 19th century book called Father and Son, in which Edmund Gosse remembers how his father handled the idea of the second coming. My father awaited with anxious hope the coming of the Lord, an event which he still frequently believed to be imminent. He would calculate, by reference to prophecies in the Old and New Testament, the exact date of this event. The date would pass without the expected event, and he would be more than disappointed. He would be incensed. Then he would understand that he must have made some slight error in calculation, and the pleasure of anticipation would recommence. It's all there. The date setting, the failure, the refusal to blame Paul or Peter or James, the acceptance of some error in computing, and finally the fervent faith once again that this time it would happen right on schedule. I'll show you, out of hundreds of such cases, a classic example of how it has worked in modern times. Charles Russell, first president of the Jehovah's Witness sect, announced 1914 as the date for the second coming. When nothing seemed to happen, his successor, a lawyer by the name of Rutherford, explained what he saw as a kind of four-year mistake. That is, the world really had ended legally in 1914. It was just that nobody had noticed. It would actually end, however, in 1918. It is not easy to discourage a prophet. So when 1918 came and passed and nothing seemed to happen again, Mr. Rutherford was ready with still another solution. He wrote a book in 1920 called Millions Now Living Will Never Die, one of the famous books in this whole business. And in that book he said, all right, folks, the world ended legally in 1914, as Russell predicted, and invisibly in 1918, as I predicted, but the true and visible end will now come, I promise you, in 1925, and millions now living will see it happen. Well, 1925 came and went with no trumpets and no shout of the archangel, the third public failure in 10 years, and many of the faithful were disillusioned. But Mr. Rutherford survived it very well. He took up residence in a beautiful mansion near San Diego, which he had arranged earlier to have reserved for King David and Gideon and other biblical heroes who would soon be rising up to greet the Lord. Fortunately for Mr. Rutherford, the deed gave him, and I am quoting the contract, exclusive possession, use and benefit for and during his life on earth, and stipulated that it could not be sold. Since the Lord delayed his coming once again, the prophet had the pleasures of living there until 1942, when he died at the age of 72, proof that being wrong may not be so bad if one has made the right arrangements. In the last 30 years, second coming fever has raged unchecked. About 8 years ago one night, I watched Billy Graham and Oral Roberts as they sat on two three-legged stools looking into each other's faces from a distance of about a yard. And I saw them solemnly assure each other on national television that this time there was no doubt about it. The Lord would be returning very, very soon. One had the distinct impression that they were suggesting weeks, months, certainly less than a year from the tone of it. I marveled at their confidence, unshaken by 20 centuries of predictions and failures. Hal Lindsey, who is the brightest star in all the heaven of doomsday prophets, has sold over 15 million copies of a book called The Late Great Planet Earth, a book with some of the most sensational predictions ever put into print. At the time, Mr. Lindsey set the second coming for a very interesting year, 1988. But as that date got closer, he decided to juggle the figures a little to give himself a little more flexibility. He tied in a few current events with a few obscure Bible verses, quoted the command of Christ that this generation will not pass away until these things take place, and then with a perfectly straight face told his audience up in Toronto, Canada, "We are that generation. I am looking on the faces of some who will never die." Needless to report, the audience loved it. I keep a folder of stories about these predictions and about people gathering in their houses in Arkansas or Montana and saying they will not come out until the Lord returns, but the clock saves you from having to hear them. I can't resist telling you that in 1980, radio evangelist Willie Day Smith said on a Saturday over 29 radio stations that the Lord would arrive on the following Tuesday. That Tuesday, as it turned out, was April the 1st, But the humor of that fact did not strike Willie. I have not heard, but I would guess that like other prophets, he simply reset the date. At the other end of the theological spectrum are mainstream Protestants who read the images about the sky splitting and the trumpet sounding and the archangel shouting as a part of the thought world of the first century. For many of them, the second coming makes sense only as a metaphor for the eventual victory of good over the forces of evil. But whether they read like this or literally, they wisely remember the words of Christ when his own disciples became too curious about dates. "It is not for you to know," he said, "the times or seasons which the Father has fixed by his own authority." But that warning has always been ignored, and it always will be. Next week, next month, next year, someone will print a brand new set of facts and figures and verses to prove that the second coming is at last upon us. I've taken no survey to know how you feel as congregationalists, free to feel as heart and mind dictate. But it will be appropriate, no matter how you feel, I think, to say this. The next time you hear a time-setting prophet, remember the long, long past and the strewn wreckage of 1,000 mistaken predictions, and stay busy doing something useful. Amen.